Opioid addiction is a major problem in Georgia. Several years ago, Governor Nathan Deal signed the Good Samaritan Bill. Its goal is to prevent opioid overdose deaths. It gives amnesty to anyone who reports drug-related emergencies. It also equips law enforcement and first responders with naloxone, a drug that can reverse overdoses if given right away. The law is having some effects. I talked about this with Andy Miller of Georgia Health News. Also joining us was Mona Bennett of the Atlanta Harm Reduction Coalition, and we spoke to them originally last year. Andy, about how many opioid deaths does Georgia deal with on a daily basis?
In 2015, we had more than 1,300 drug overdose deaths, and among those, probably 90% or close to it were opioid overdose deaths. So, and this is a number that undoubtedly has gone up even since then.
And when we talk about opioids, is that just prescription painkillers? Does that include things like heroin? What does it include?
It's heroin, it's fentanyl, it's definitely a problem everywhere probably, but probably north of I-20 here in Georgia, where it's hitting the hardest here in our state.
Now, in theory, Andy, how effective is naloxone at reversing an opioid overdose?
It's very effective, and police departments and sheriff's personnel all over the state are using it, and all over the country, really. I wouldn't want to call it a miracle drug, but it certainly is very successful in reversing these overdoses.
Now, Mona, in practice, how effective are we seeing it be with first responders having it in their kit and being able to administer it to people in an emergency?
It is very effective. First responders tend to use the Narcan brand nasal spray or the Evzio naloxone auto injector. And those are very easy to use, and they are very effective in the field. And they are also very effective with the true first responders, the people who first witness the overdose and are able to respond by using community-provided naloxone and by calling 911 when necessary.
You say community-provided naloxone. What do you mean by that? How is naloxone getting into the hands of people who aren't healthcare professionals, but people who might just happen to be around a drug overdose?
Well, the law, OCGA 16-13-5, allows for the public to be trained on and to get and to use and to pass on, if necessary, naloxone. And the Georgia Overdose Prevention and the Atlanta Harm Reduction Coalition make sure that people who feel like they need naloxone for loved ones are able to get it.
What are the costs?
Well, right now, naloxone is pretty cheap. I really can't tell how much, but it is pretty cheap for the vial naloxone. Now, it seems like the cost rises with the technology to administer it. The Evzio talks to you. It talks you through the process of administering naloxone. Well, that's not cheap. there is a new nasal naloxone. It is easier to use. You don't have to put anything together. That's not cheap either. But naloxone, being a generic drug, and it's been around since early 70s, 1974, it is a very cheap drug. We have to remember that, and we have to keep manufacturers' feet to the fire to make sure that it is affordable.
Andy, how does Georgia's efforts here to reduce overdose deaths from opioid abuse, how does this compare to efforts being done by other states around the country?
Well, Adam, there's 37 states that have these immunity laws, which basically, as you described, if someone is having an overdose or sees one happening of a friend or a family member, they are immune under this law from being prosecuted for drug possession or possessing drug paraphernalia or whatever. And these laws, certain jurisdictions are saying this is a really good thing. We can now talk to these folks and get them the help that they need without them fearing for prosecution. Now, one challenge is to get the word out among the drug users about their friends and family members, that if they call 911 in our state and 36 other states, they won't be prosecuted for possession of the drug. And this is an education effort that we need to do more widely.
Indeed.
I suppose, go ahead, Mona.
That's what the Atlanta Harm Reduction Coalition does, and that's what the Georgia Overdose Prevention does all across the state of Georgia. But it is a huge job that, we need help.
I suppose that one of the policy arguments against something like a Good Samaritan law, which makes it so that people can report a drug emergency without fear of getting in trouble themselves. I suppose one of the arguments against such a policy is that we as a society maybe don't want to be making doing illegal drugs safer. We want to keep it scary so that people are disinclined to do it. Either of you want to respond to that argument?
Well, I talked to the Sheriff's Association, Georgia Sheriff's Association, and they told me they're much more interested in getting people help on this issue versus throwing people in jail. They see that the value of human life in this, and they see that the scourge of opioids are inflicting on Georgians. And so they're good with this law, and they're good with trying to get people the help, both from the Narcan or Naloxone, but also the immunity provisions as well.
Mona, you've been sort of observing this issue for many, many years. I wonder what's different now from when we look at the law enforcement response to the opioid epidemic compared to the law enforcement response to the crack epidemic, which was much more punitive and much less treatment-oriented. Is it just because crack epidemic was at least stereotypically associated with black people and opioid epidemic has been hitting more white people?
Yes, indeed. The crack epidemic was criminalized heavily and still is, but, well, now that rich white suburban kids are overdosing and dying, it's all of a sudden a health issue, a problem. It is
my
job.
On the other hand, you would agree with that, though, right? That it is a health issue.
I hate that it took suburban white kids dying when there were plenty of black and brown peoples dying for decades from opioid overdoses. But it is my job to make sure that everyone gets the benefit of this new law.
Now, let's talk about what's been going on in Atlanta. I understand that Atlanta PD has been putting some particular effort into this sort of notorious high drug crime neighborhood, the Bluff in Atlanta. What's been the experience there?
Well, I wished Atlanta PD would talk about it a little more. I know that they have reversed at least 11 opioid overdoses, and I hear tell of plans to roll out naloxone for the officers in all the other zones, but I'm not quite sure about that, so please ask the Atlanta Police Department about that.
Okay. I'll just remind listeners that naloxone is a drug that, when administered quickly, can reduce a death from an opioid overdose. It's something that legislation has put into the hands of first responders recently in Georgia. Andy Miller, what are the other frontiers that could be explored in terms of addressing the opioid epidemic in Georgia?
Well, I think Georgia is really, over the last few years, tried to crack down on the pill mills, which are basically physicians writing prescriptions for people of these pain medications just willy-nilly without knowing the patient or anything like that. Basically,
yeah, I feel like every other week I see a notice of an indictment of a doctor.
Right, and I think that's a great thing. That's one thing that the state has done. Another thing is they're trying to more closely monitor legitimate doctors' painkiller prescribing habits, and so there's more scrutiny on that as well. So those are two things that we can do. I think, but I think, you know, to think one of the biggest things we can do, obviously, is break up the drug distribution rings in order to cut down on the availability of opioids.
Mona, what else needs to be done in 45 seconds?
We need to be mindful of chronic pain patients who have legitimate use for high doses of opioids. They must not suffer in these efforts. Also, we have to remember that this medical amnesty law also covers the underage purchase and possession of alcohol. There are still too many people from 9-year-olds to 20-year-olds who are dying of alcohol poisoning, alcohol overdoses, and this law covers them. It also covers the person who calls, makes the call seeking help, and it covers the person who is having the any drug-related medical emergency.
That's Andy Miller, editor of Georgia Health News. Also with us was Mona Bennett of the Atlanta Harm Reduction Coalition. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Argusian. All this month, to mark Women's History Month, we are saluting female trailblazers. Leah Ward Sears is certainly among them. She was the first African-American female Chief Justice of any United States Supreme Court. She was Chief Justice of the Georgia Supreme Court from 2005 to 2009. And she spoke last year with my colleague, Tony Harris.
Your Honor.
Thank you.
Justice.
Thank you so much.
Welcome, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Can we dive into the deep end of the
pool
here, right off the top here?
I'll try not to drown.
No, okay, you won't. You won't. Look, your work has been about resolving conflicts.
Right.
That's your work. That's your life work. I don't want to be a prisoner of the present moment. The nation, I need to remind myself, fought a civil war. There was the fight for civil rights in this country. But I need you to put this current moment of polarization, incivility, into context. Can you do that for us?
I will try. Let me give it to you like this.
Yeah.
The day after President Trump was elected, I have a daughter who's a millennial. She's 30 years old. She called me in tears. She was not really a big Hillary supporter, but definitely not a Trump supporter. And she was, at 30 years old, she was upset about the incivility in this country. How could this be? How could we be so divided?
Specifically what? What was troubling her?
Well, I mean, some of the comments that a man who had made comments off on that Access Hollywood tape, and some of the comments that had been made, and the terrible tone that the election took overall. She asked, how could this be? And my first reaction to her was, look, Brennan, you're 30, but I'm 62. So I was born in 1955. I lived through the civil rights movement. I lived through the women's rights movement. I lived through a time in Savannah when I'd get up every morning and there was this fellow named J.B. Stoner. He was a racist from Cobb County, I thought. I think he was. He would had an ad every morning saying, you nigger this, you nigger that, you nigger that. And I remember how my mother would get so upset, she'd call the radio station or TV station and say, get that man off the air. My children are trying to eat so they can go to school. This is nothing new in this. That's what I was telling her, is this is just another bump in the road. And I do believe that we will, as a nation, get through this period if people of goodwill work to get us through this period, and we'll be fine.
I notice
it's a bad period, though.
I notice in referencing the Access Hollywood tape, you mentioned the man. You didn't mention Donald Trump by name.
I try. Well, you know,
is there a reason for that?
Well, I have been I've been a judge a long time. I've been a judge most of my life, since my 20s. And so I try very hard in the public sphere, not to jump into political battles. You know, I talk about civility. I talk about ethical things. I talk about morality things. But I think you have more power when you do what judges do, which is what judges are supposed to do, which is don't jump into the political battle of the time, because one side won't listen to you.
But Justice Sears, I want to get to that point in just a moment, but Justice Sears, look, everyone is asking you. I'm sure friends, colleagues, acquaintances, folks you meet in your day-to-day are asking you to explain from your point of view, hey, can you explain how it is Donald Trump won the election and is the 45th president of the United States? What do you say to people?
I can't explain that.
You really can't?
No, I can't. Let me try.
Thank you.
Okay. I think that there is a deep upset and distrust among many, many Americans of the political status quo. And I don't think it all boils down to racism, although I think there's a good chunk of it there.
On a percentage basis, how much of it is racism?
Maybe 50-50.
You think it's 50-50?
I think it's a lot of racism.
And that's a lot.
It's a lot of racism. And it's racial views unexpressed or unexplored. You know, people don't really sometimes, when they're afraid or when they're angry, they don't know from whence it comes. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is fear of what they don't understand. But I think a lot of it is economics, of the fear that I won't get enough and others are taking mine, be it blacks.
People
or
of color.
People of color or immigrants, you know, coming to this country. But I believe I know some Trump supporters who won't tell me they're Trump supporters, okay. Which is an issue right there. But who I don't believe are all that racist. I can't say there's no racism there. I think everybody has something about the other group that you have to deal with.
So I sort of compartmentalized our interview here.
Yes.
And this section is, I just called it Bringing Up Baby. Bringing, yes. As a child, your life as a child. You're quoted in the book saying, one of the defining features of my upbringing has been race. Here's the quote. In my very, very early years, race was not an issue. I didn't know I was any different from all the kids that I grew up with.
Right.
They were all white. I just thought, I was like everyone else. I was brown, and they were not as brown.
Right.
Right?
That's right.
So talk about race as a defining issue in your life.
No, I thought, I grew up, I was born on a military base in Germany. My father was an army officer. So, and the army at that time was very segregated, not by race, but by class or rank.
Yeah.
Okay, so we lived in the officers' area, played with the officers' kids, and didn't mix much with NCOs and others. So I thought, and the other thing, just looking at my two parents, my father is a very dark-skinned,
yes,
African-American man, and my mother is a very light-skinned African-American woman. So, you know, without asking a lot of questions, I just thought that some people, that race was, skin color was like eye color.
Right.
That some people were dark skinned. I mean, is that so stupid?
No, of course not.
And that some people were light skinned, and I was in the middle, brown skin. And
right.
So that was that. But I do remember very playing with these kids, running. These were the days when your parents would let you run out.
Those days.
You were free, and my father would then stand on the corner, and he had this whistle, and we knew it was my father, and we'd all come running.
So you've given me a perfect moment to tell everyone about the book and to reintroduce you. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with former Georgia Supreme Court Justice Leah Ward Sears, Supreme Court Chief Justice. Wow. Her biography is called Seizing Serendipity by Rebecca Davis. Do you remember the first time you were called a nigger?
Yeah, I was playing out in the woods on the post, the army post, and this kid turned around. I was old enough to be outside playing, and he said, those niggers. And I thought, oh, damn, this doesn't sound good. And I also remember when we came to the United States on a ship. Yeah. There's a picture in the book on us coming to the United States. My mother is holding me and my brother's there. And we rented a car or got a car. I don't know if they were. And we drove through New York City. And I noticed that there were the city was segregated, that black people were in one part and white people, and I was in the back seat, and I said to my parents, "What's going on? Don't you notice that the black people are on one side of the city and the white people?" And I remember, you know, this is when the father drove and the mother sat on the and they looked at each other, and there was this knowing look like, "Oh Lordy, we have a lot of work to do."
We had not
been exposed to that, and I was like 6 or 7 by then.
How old were you when the family moved to Savannah?
Junior high. It was called junior high school, so 12 or 13.
Now it's middle school or something, right?
It's middle school.
Right.
Yeah, but at the time.
I remember those junior high school days. Yeah,
it was like, so that would be 12 or 13.
So I can't let you go without having you reflect on your years growing up in Savannah. What do you remember about those years?
I liked Savannah. My father liked Savannah. I actually felt more comfortable in Savannah. I loved Atlanta. I jumped on a train with a friend of mine, lied to my parents, shouldn't have done that, but jumped on.
That's a really good story in the book, by the way.
Yeah, called the Nancy Hanks. Told my father we were coming up to do one thing, and we went to Rich's department store. And I'd never seen anything like it, and I fell in love with Atlanta.
Yeah.
So.
Let's bring it forward.
Yes.
Was Ambassador Andy Young the first person to put the idea of becoming a judge in your mind? Or
yes.
Was this someone?
Yeah, my goal was to be Thurgood Marshall.
Okay? Really?
Yeah, I was going to.
From what age?
From as long as I could remember. Like, see, I just followed the Warren Burger Court, Thurgood Marshall. I knew who Justice Brennan, I named my daughter Brennan after William Brennan.
No kidding. Okay.
I could name her Thurgood, seriously. Okay, but so I named my daughter Brennan, and I followed from the earliest. So I was going to be a civil rights lawyer and change the law. I was going to change big cases.
I see.
You know, now you get your. But the problem is, I was born too late. You know, Thurgood Marshall, it had already been done.
Yeah.
So by the time I got to Atlanta and I met Ambassador Young, his goal was to put African Americans on the benches. There were very few when he became mayor. Maybe four in the state on the whole state superior court system. And he said what he was going to do is pick young women and men. But young women and groom them, and that's what he did.
And obviously, the rise is extraordinary from that point on. Why did then Democratic Governor Zell Miller appoint you to the Georgia Supreme Court? This was in 1992.
Right.
You were 36 years old.
Right.
Here's the real question I want to ask you: were you selected for the color of your skin and the content of your character?
I think both, and I think my intelligence.
Of course.
From what I heard. For his executive assistant, because I think he had someone else in mind. I'm sure he had. So I come walking in, and I knew he had someone else in mind. But I told him I had this long list of historical characters who had done things at young age. That Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence. Our men fight it, and it was men at the time,
yes.
At 18, and blah, blah, blah. And when I left, his executive counsel assistant said she said I was feisty. And I also remember offering him advice on how to settle a lawsuit. I just didn't have... Gosh, I just didn't know I wasn't supposed to do that.
Just as Leah Ward Sears is here, were you convinced that you were up for the job? Was there a part of you that thought, I'm maybe a bit in over my head with this job?
Well, when I applied, I knew I wasn't getting the job.
Okay.
Now, But when he called, when Zell Miller called, Governor Miller called, I was speechless. And people started gathering around the walls of my chambers. And they thought that I had been appointed to a seat. There was an open seat on the Court of Appeals at that time. And they thought I had gotten that seat. And at a certain point in the conversation, I looked up and I said to the people who were trying to be quiet, because I'm talking to the governor, I said, he put me on the Supreme Court. And they went, wow, you know, and all that. So he knew I had a crowd there. I did think, let me say this, I did think, whoa, this is going to be tough. But I knew I was driving around 285 on my way to work, and this thing came into my head that God doesn't give you more than you can chew. Now, you're going to get in there, and you're going to do everything that you need to do to be a success because you have people riding on it, and you will not fail. And God did not put you there to fail, so you just go on and do it.
Your reaction to what I'm about to play for you. Ready? Let's roll clip one.
Chances are, 'cause I wear a silly grin.
Johnny Mathis.
Yes.
What did he mean to you growing up?
Is this in the book?
Yes, it's
really?
In the book.
Okay, I gotta read. Well, I was visiting my aunt in San Diego. I gotta study.
Now, I don't have much time,
okay,
but I need
I was visiting my aunt in San Diego, and we were just, this is 1968, and we were just swooning. She had just had a baby, and I remember my Aunt Jewel saying, you know, he goes to the other side or something like that, some old thing. And I was like, what do you mean? And this was the first time I realized that some people were gay.
That's Leah Ward Sears, jurist and former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Georgia. She spoke with my colleague, Tony Harris, and that conversation is part of the series that we're using to mark Women's History Month. Who is a notable female trailblazer in Georgia that you think we should include in our series? You can call us at 404-500-9457, or we're on Twitter at OSTTalk. Just ahead, we add two more songs to our Georgia playlist, but first, bringing more diversity to classical music, this is On Second Thought. Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. I am joining you right now, as I always do, from Macon, Georgia, where the citywide headline right now is our annual Cherry Blossom Festival. Tomorrow, we detail the cherry blossom's fascinating history and why Macon has all these darn Yoshino cherry trees. What questions or comments do you have about the cherry blossom? Give us a call and leave a message. We're at 404-500-9457, and be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more.
The world of classical music has a diversity problem. The League of American Orchestras says people of color make up only about 4% of U.S. symphony players. In Georgia, the Atlanta Music Project is working to balance those scales, also known as AMP, Atlanta Music Project, AMP. The program provides free training and instruments to underserved students in Southwest Atlanta. AMP won a grant of $80,000 from the Carnegie Hall Foundation, one of only 13 awarded across the country. And with me now is Dante Rameau, co-founder and executive director of the Atlanta Music Project. Hi, Dante.
Good morning, Adam.
Glad to have you. Also with us from Detroit is Rick Robinson, who's the founder of Cut Time Productions, which works to make classical music more accessible to a wider audience. Hi, Rick.
Hi. Hi, guys.
So, Dante, what does the Atlanta Music Project do?
Well, the Atlanta Music Project is now in its eighth year of operations. And what we do is we provide intensive music education for underserved youth right in their neighborhood. And a lot of people ask me, well, Dante, what do you mean by underserved? And what we'll do is we'll look at neighborhoods and communities in metropolitan Atlanta and identify areas where you might not find a lot of youth orchestras or youth choirs, or you might not find very robust music programs in the schools. So we're targeting musically underserved neighborhoods. But this usually is found in neighborhoods where you have a lot of schools with high rates of free reduced lunch students, and also neighborhoods where there are lower levels of income. So we tend to end up in neighborhoods south of I-20 in Atlanta.
Let's listen to some of your kids. Here is the Amp Orchestra performing Fanfare for the Common Man by Aaron Copland last year. So Dante Rameau, a lot of the kids you can see in this video are very, very young, and I imagine you're starting them late in a lot of circumstances. They sound pretty good nonetheless. What is your goal? What do you consider success with these kids?
Well, becoming a musician, proficient on a music instrument, requires a lot of skills and character traits that I think are valuable and applicable to all parts of your life. So mostly I want our kids to feel a very high sense of self-worth. I want them to feel like they matter, like their voice matters, and that they can do really big things. And we just happen to be using music as a vehicle. You can do it through sports. You can do it through academics. We just happen to be doing it through music. So an example is we've got three students who this summer got to participate in a national music festival called Take a Stand in Los Angeles, and they got to perform at Walt Disney Concert Hall, home of the Los Angeles Philharmonic, under the baton of Gustavo Dudamel, the famous conductor. And, you know, this is all due to their hard work and their dedication to their craft. And I think when they have those kinds of experiences, I think they feel like they have more control over the outcome in their lives.
Rick Robinson with Cut Time Productions in Detroit. You're doing different things to try to make classical music more accessible to people who might not necessarily normally find it or be exposed to it. You've got this group called the Cut Time Players. It's an octet. And the concerts, if people go and listen to the music online, they just sound like a whole lot of fun. Do you think that the mission is working?
I think it's growing. It necessarily starts small because we need to experiment for what people react most positively to. And, you know, it tends to be the cream of the crop, something familiar, something with a strong beat and ways that they can join in, like playing toy percussion with us.
That's great. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Dante Rameau, executive director of the Atlanta Music Project, and also Rick Robinson, founder of Cut Time Productions in Detroit, two gentlemen who are trying to make classical music more accessible to a wider array of people. And Dante, I wonder, the argument that you make about the value of classical music education is very, very strong, and it's a very, very common argument. But it's, you know, it fundamentally is the case that historically speaking, classical music is a European tradition. And if kids, especially kids of color, don't find it to be really relevant to them, do you ever worry that maybe you're foisting European cultural hegemony on them?
No, I don't worry about that, because what we're doing is we're teaching kids the language of music. And we happen to start at the very beginning in a traditional Western music education philosophy, where you're learning to read notes and, you know, you're playing semitones and tones and half steps and whole steps and all that kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, we're teaching them to play an instrument, and they now have the ability, once they get to a level of proficiency where they can read any kind of music, where they can play by ear, they can now do whatever they want. And I think that's really, really empowering. And of course, at the Atlanta Music Project, 95% of our students are African American. So we have to be very, very intentional about what kind of repertoire we have our kids playing. So, of course, we'll teach them Mozart, Beethoven, but we also do pop music, and we also do jazz, and we also do spirituals. In fact, last year, we did an entire concert of only black music, music from the Caribbean, music from Africa, music from black America. So we don't, it's really about giving them the power to do what they want, but also being mindful of where we are teaching, being mindful of the culture of our students, and being mindful of the diversity that's available in music.
Sure. Let's actually listen to some other kinds of music that your kids do. You've got a choral group called Amplify. Amplify Zabin is the name of this choir, performing a choral arrangement of the Andra Day song, Rise Up. That's nice, Dante. Do you do that arrangement yourself?
No, I did not. I will give all credit to our director of choirs, Aisha Moody, and our choir director, Verena Lucia Anders. I'll stay out of that one, but thank you.
Okay. Rick Robinson, founder of Cut Time Productions in Detroit, sort of a similar question to you. You know, if people aren't finding classical music on their own, is that potentially an indication that it is legitimately not relevant to their cultural identity and their life experience? And, you know, what's the value of pushing it on them?
Well, I find, you know, life is always about how we look at things, how we take things. And while classical music has this past of being European, I mean, just like books, it becomes a universal source of not only inspiration, but self-reflection, as well as getting your voice out. So the ability to read English can lead to being able to write books or articles or rants if we want to. And the same can be said for music. If we pick up this tool off the floor, blow the dust off, it becomes a very powerful tool.
That's Rick Robinson, founder of Cut Time Productions. You also heard there from Dante Ramone, co-founder and executive director of the Atlanta Music Project. What music appeals to grand opera singers? Well, mezzo-soprano Jamie Barton grew up in Rome, Georgia. At 36, she holds the Richard Tucker Award, a $50,000 prize often called the Heisman Trophy of music. She's performed all over the world and just concluded her performance in Verdi's Don Carlo at the Washington National Opera. We asked Jamie Barton to contribute to our occasional series called the Georgia Playlist. The rules are simple. We ask people to share two songs that they think are quintessentially Georgia. And there are a couple of other rules. Their picks have to be written or performed by someone with a strong Georgia connection, and it can't be one of your own songs. So here's the latest installment of the Georgia Playlist with mezzo-soprano Jamie Barton.
My name is Jamie Barton. I'm an opera singer, and I live in Cabbage Town, Atlanta, Georgia. I'm a mezzo-soprano.
Well, I just found out today that little game you play. I've been sleeping home another way.
The first song I would like to talk about is Sleep With One Eye Open by Michael Daves and Chris Thiele. Michael is, he's originally from Atlanta, Georgia. He now lives up in Brooklyn, where half of the bluegrass world lives right now. It's more of the music that is really a part of what I love about this song. The lyrics, in a way, are kind of, you know, inconsequential. I've heard Chris Thiele actually talk about that. He comes up with the music first and then fits lyrics around it. And I can see that being the case in this particular song. My love for music started in bluegrass and classic rock. And I still love bluegrass. I think it's an incredibly virtuosic, very malleable kind of genre. You can see that malleability with the progressive bluegrass that's going on now. And just if you listen to a banjo player, if you listen to Chris Thiele playing the mandolin or Michael Daves playing the guitar, you hear something that is extraordinary when it comes to the technique. I honestly think that minus the instrumentation and the difference in the genres, we're actually, opera is, classical music in general is actually fairly tied to what they're doing. The second song that I have chosen is Du bist die Ruhe, being sung by a phenomenal opera treasure of Georgia, Roland Hayes, who, as it turns out, was born less than 10 miles from where I grew up. And I think there might be something to the phrase, there's something in the water. This one in particular, I think, is really beautiful. It's an art song, a very famous one that I haven't actually sung yet, but it's just so beautifully sung. It sounds like a lullaby, and he does it just so sweetly. It's phenomenal, really. He was singing at the turn of the 1900s. He was one of the pioneers as an American artist in general, but as a Black American artist, he made amazing headway. There's this incredible story of him in Germany standing up to sing, and the crowds absolutely trying to shout him down, and he just stood there and waited until they got it out of their system, and then he started singing, and they gave him a standing ovation because it was so beautiful. But they had never had a Black artist in their midst, and they didn't know how to handle it. And so he was an ambassador not only for this art, but for diversity. I think there is a Georgia sound, but I also think that it encompasses so many different areas. You have this earthiness, I think, to the artistry that I hear out of Georgia artists. It doesn't matter if you're talking about Roland Hayes, Michael Daves, the B-52s, or whoever else. You have this truthful, of-the-earth kind of sound and artistry that comes up. And I think people respond to that everywhere. And I think we have that in spades with Georgia.
That was mezzo-soprano Jamie Barton sharing her picks for our Georgia playlist. And that's it for our show today, but as always, we want to hear from you. You just heard Jamie's contributions to our Georgia playlist. What is your favorite song by a Georgia artist? Call us at 404-500-9457, or you can post on Twitter or Facebook. On Twitter, we're at OST Talk. Our show is produced by Maura Curry, Fenley Foxen, LaRaven Taylor, Leighton Powell, and Summer Evans. Sean Powers is the senior producer, Don Smith edits the show, and Tanya Ott is the executive producer. The engineer is Tyler Morris. Special thanks to our interns, Emmanuel Johnson, Emily Bunker, and Reed Williams. The theme music is Silent Machine by Georgia's own Cat Power. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusea. Have a good one.